Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 183 on virtual wholesale real estate investing with Brandon Barnes. If you're into building wealth through real estate investing, you are in the right place. My goal is to identify high-caliber real estate investors and other industry service providers. I invite them onto the show and then draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars and more in the business of real estate. Now, most real estate investors, including myself, prefer making offers after physically seeing the house. You know, you go see the condition, underwrite the deal, figure out the values, they have to repair value, and then make an offer. Today's guest, Brandon Barnes, he used to do the same, but now he prefers making all of his offers immediately over the phone without ever seeing the property or even seeing photos of the property. I mean, how does this work? Don't we need to know the condition of the house to make an offer? Or at a minimum, see the photos? These answers may surprise you. All right. Welcome, Brandon Barnes, to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm well. Thank you for having me there.
Yeah, for sure. So it's been much anticipated. Your name's been floating around the Atlanta market where I do a lot of business for the past couple years here. So I was, you know, highly excited to look forward to having you get on the show here once we started getting together with bookings. But for those that may not know who Brandon Barnes already is, do you want to kind of give a little bit of a background for us, Brandon? Maybe how you began real estate investing and maybe even the details about your first deal, if you could go back to that, that origination.
Yeah, for sure. So, look, I'm here in the Atlanta area, just like you mentioned. I started off my journey wholesaling specifically. And that's just the art of finding off-market properties at a discount. And, you know, kind of jump into this game by chance, honestly. I got fired from my corporate America job, and I always thought I'd climb the ladder and become an entrepreneur at some perfect opportunity. But I got fired, and I reached out to a buddy that I knew from Pittsburgh when I was working for the H.J. Heinz company up there, and I asked him what this real estate thing was all about, and he said he had actually moved to Atlanta and was following a mentor program for wholesaling, and I should come by and listen to it. And this is a great opportunity to start a business. And I was sold. You know, just a few months in, the second month, I sent a 1,000 postcards and got my first contract. And by month three, I had actually done my first deal for $15K and never looked back. I split that deal with him and kept on mailing. So it was a great intro into the business.
Nice. So that first deal, right, did you go back, like, to the actual house and the appointment? Because I know we're going to get in a little bit of a transition to what you're doing now, but I'm going out on a limb and assuming you started slightly different than what the business model is now. Can you take me back to, like, literally, you know, you set the appointment and maybe what happened when you got to the living room, if that's how you did it?
Yeah, for sure. Look, I used to go to every appointment in person, tried to build incredible rapport, talk to homeowners, craft the perfect offer, and hope to goodness they signed. And so that was exactly what happened with that one. I think I got a call from the lady, and I don't think I met her specifically, but that was an outlier because I would go to appointments in person all the time. And so I started off my business and started off my career sending a lot of mail, doing a lot of direct mail, and it was just on that first 1,000 postcards. I had a lady with a tax lien issue and wanted to just sell the property. Probably shot myself in the foot because I got it under contract for about $20,000 and sold it for $35,000. I probably should have at least been able to sell that for $50,000. It was a great little 3-2 townhome. But yeah, I was going to every appointment in person, driving all around the city. But it would be weeks that, you know, maybe I got out 3 or 4 contracts and I was never going to get anywhere operating like that, trying to be everything for everybody. So, you know, these days we send a lot more offers, that's to say the least.
Nice. Yeah, this reminds me some of the circumstances when you mention like 1,000 postcards and you get a deal from that amount. So I think back to my first deal. Yeah, the numbers are like a little different now, but I was down to my last $100 and I put like a $79 newspaper advertisement in for 1 week, and I ended up getting 3 or 4 calls in that 1 week. This is 2006. So the newspaper, for those that don't remember, was a much more effective medium of advertising than it is now. But I remember when I got there, right, and I'm making the offer, and I didn't really know how to, like, analyze markets and do comps, and I had no access to the MLS, and it was in, like, a very high crime, high drug activity neighborhood. And I remember seeing that a friend of mine bought one on Remington Street, a guy I knew from the RIA meetings, for $5,500. I'm sorry, he bought it for $6,000. And so I figured, well, I'll offer $5,500 to this other one around the corner, and then I'll go sell it to him and make $500. And I get into the living room. I think I might have looked at the house and then came back because I chickened out on making the offer the first time. And I show up the second time, and the family's there, and I got my, like, 6-year-old daughter with me in not the greatest neighborhood. My dad had to drive me to the deal. And I made the offer of $5,500, and they, like, talked about it for a minute, and they pretty much flat out accepted. Like, my negotiation skills were all but non-existent at the time. And I remember I'm sitting down, Brandon. I had to fill out the agreement of sale. We stopped at Office Max and bought a generic agreement of sale, and I'm like, oh, I didn't do this before. Crap. What information goes where? And, like, I didn't have the sense to actually, like, practice the agreement of sale way back when. But I called a guy on Remington Street, and I'm like, hey, do you want to buy this one for me for $6,000? He's like, I'll sell you mine for $5,500. They call it Remington Street because of all the shell casings all over the ground every time I go to pick up the rent. I'm like, oh, what have I done? But I lucked out, sold it for $11,500, and $6,000 later, same as you, was kind of off to the races. But, like, early on, right, that where I was referencing the 1,000 postcards and my $79 advertising, that's not the case for a lot of investors who go out and attempt the off-market deal business. And that what I'm getting at is there's, like, almost this, like, certain element of luck where you and I got lucky on that. And, man, I wish I did a deal for every 1,000 pieces of mail that I sent out since then. But without that luck, maybe we wouldn't have been so ambitious to kind of keep going. Like, you know, how much in your opinion, right? Yes, there's skill. Yes, there's luck. But, like, how important is luck, or how much is luck and how much is skill, would you say, for people maybe just starting out, so that when they get in there, if they don't see that instantaneous luck, maybe they stick to it and go through the storm and get to the other side where you begin to get that momentum?
Yeah, 100%. Look, I was definitely lucky, because then the next thousands of postcards I was sending out after that, crickets, and or just not any good deals. And the success often happens in the outliers, and there was no reason that I should have gotten a 15K deal from that 1,000 postcards, but there was some luck there. And I hope that a lot of people, you know, get lucky in those early days, because you just need that proof of concept early on. And there's so many people that start and don't get lucky, or, you know, they're beating their head against the wall for months without any traction or any deal flow. So, you know, definitely, I think we both got lucky early on, because, you know, I promise you, I started to send, you know, 5,000 postcards, 3,000 postcards every week, and I ended up burning through my cash in those first few months of that very first year, 2016, wholesaling. And it was actually just listening to podcasts, just like this one, where I ran across the Joe McCall podcast, and he had interviewed Rick Ginn, the probate king of Florida. And I thought that that was a great opportunity for me to differentiate myself. And so I started, you know, going after probate leads and sending letters at way less volume, but that turned into some major deal flow for me. It was really probate deals that saved my business that second half of the year. I probably did $86,000 on like $3,000 worth of mail sending probate letters.
Nice. So one more moment on our little beginner stories there. Do you remember the phone call when you made the offer and maybe that seller accepted on that original deal? Is there any recollection of that you could share?
Yeah, so that, you know, look, that very first deal, I remember where I was in my house. I remember that I was in the basement and I was scared to death to ask her, you know, if she would accept an offer of 19K for this townhouse. And I know, I remember she thought about it. She said that she had to, you know, consider some things, but it felt like she was, you know, moving in the right direction. She was actually going to consider this $19,000 offer. But I didn't know what I didn't know. And looking back on it, I could have paid a lot more and I could have sold it for a lot more. But I just kind of remember that trepidation of, should I ask her? Like, is this enough? And it's something that my mentor always says, like, if you have that uneasy feeling in your stomach, you're probably making a good offer. So I had that. I definitely had that bubbly feeling in my stomach. Like, is this good enough? And sure enough, we actually proceeded and moved forward.
Yeah, and I asked for the details there, and I appreciate you diving just like you did into them, because I think for a lot of people, even people who've been in the business a really long time, Brandon, I noticed that the hesitation moment in the real estate business as an investor comes at the moment of making the offer, right? That's where, for new people who have low experience or maybe no access to the MLS, you got this challenge of getting your hands on the right data to be able to even figure out what the number is. But let's say you figure out what the number is, then there comes this other piece of actually presenting that offer to the seller. And maybe that can be more difficult over the phone and even more difficult in person with the seller than perhaps how you're doing it now. So let's just talk about the Brandon Barnes now of offers over appointments as a strategy.
Yeah, for sure. So what I started to realize is that, you know, if I wasn't making enough offers and if they weren't getting out the door, we were generating leads a little quicker. And if I wasn't making enough offers, I was not giving us an opportunity to do deals. So just to double back a little bit, towards the end of 2016, the mentor group that I was in, there was a colleague, a friend now, named Brent Daniels, that was talking about cold calling and how, you know, compared to direct mail, he was spending way less money making cold calls, and he was doing some really large deals. And I just thought that, look, here's another great opportunity. I just had my eyes open for those opportunities. And he was an open book. He shared, he said, if anybody wants to know a little bit more about it, give me a call. And I did just that. He gave me the entire, you know, model and the process. And, you know, I said, look, I think that this is it. So I was on the, you know, cutting edge of cold calling late 2016, early 17. And then I actually went on and hired some cold callers middle of that next year, so May, June of 2017. And we started to generate enough leads, but I was still trying to scramble and go to every property. And I had a buddy that did a video within that, you know, kind of mastermind group that he said, death to Podio. He was tired of being in task hell and Podio. And he said, look, we're going to keep our leads in the dialer and you can really do deals just over the phone without seller appointments. I wasn't really a believer in the beginning, but we started to try it out. And, you know, lo and behold, we were able to do deals that way just by having really good conversations and making offers. So when I found out that I could do that, I really sped up that process, hired an acquisition manager, which I had to train. He actually was one of my cold callers based in Mexico, still my acquisition manager to this day. And I had to show him how to come up with that offer price over the phone. So this kind of gets into a strategy of mine that a lot of people really like when they hear it. But, you know, if I could break it down, you know, if you think that'd be all right, I think that would really give the listener some value.
Yeah, it'd be my next question, actually.
Yeah, so what we do is instead of this ARV times 0.7 minus repair cost minus what you want to make, you know, I started to show him, I started to see this trend and realize that formula does not you know, include houses that could be just great rentals that don't need that, you know, 0.74 rehab. And so I just started to, for every property that pops up on in our dialer or, you know, any lead that I look at, you text me an address right now, I'm going to go into Zillow. I'm going to draw a little circle on the map and look at everything, you know, nearby, not crossing over any major roads or highways. Have a square footage filter that's, you know, within 500 square feet and just look at all the comps. And then as I look at all the homes that sold, if they were sold, you know, fully renovated, I'm going to click into them, look in the price history and see what price they sold at before the work was done. That gives me the price that an investor would pick it up for and what they would purchase it for before they do the rehab. So I just started to subtract my margin, what I want to make, which I suggest 20K. So you have some wiggle room, and that then becomes my maximum allowable offer. That allows us to quickly, in conversations with sellers, find out the offer price in a ballpark right there on the phone and power dial all of our leads so that we're just able to get to these properties faster, speak to homeowners over the phone, make offers, and keep it moving, because it just really cuts, it pushes us to the front of the line when we're actually speaking to them about an agreement. And that works for, you know, fully renovated properties. It also works for homes that were fixed up a little bit and listed as a rental. I'll just look into the price history of all the homes that sold, whether they were fully renovated or just mildly, you know, fixed up, their 10K investment and turned into a rental. I'll subtract my margin, and that is our maximum allowable offer.
That's interesting. So are you finding that by talking turkey on the phone with that seller, right? Because we do a little cold calling, and a lot of people, it's kind of a yes, no. It's a binary answer. Are you interested in selling? Yes. Okay, then we try to get out there and, you know, face-to-face. Are you interested in selling? No, we're not. So, like, what does the lead-in for your reps sound like to keep them on the phone? And am I right in assuming that because you're talking turkey, you're talking money and offers right there over the phone, that they're more engaged and open to kind of keep the conversation going with you? And maybe, like, what does that conversation look like from the ACT manager's vocabulary?
Yeah, look, it starts just like you mentioned, you know, from our initial prospectors, our first phone call. It's just the introduction is everything, going really high. Hey, John, look, I'm sorry this is out of the blue, but I was actually just calling about a property I believe you own at 123 Main Street. Yeah, look, we're looking to purchase a home in the area. Just wanted to see if you'd consider selling it. If they say yes, we'll continue on getting condition. You know, sounds like a great home. Why would you consider selling it? You know, what's the best price you would consider if we paid all the closing costs and, you know, there was no real estate commissions to pay, and we'll ask them for their email address and send that over to my acquisition manager very quickly so that he can dig in a little deeper. And as he's talking to people, he's trying to get a ballpark and get them to close, get them to agree to a price in that first phone call by using exactly that strategy that I just mentioned. And even when we're not close on price, we're still going to let them know, hey, we're going to send over our best offer and follow up with you and see if you got it, and we'll take it from there. So using that method, we're really able to get, you know, 50, 60, 70 offers out each and every week. And from our metrics, every 25 offers, I'm expecting a signed contract back. So we've just sped up that process. Instead of, you know, like, here's a lead, let me send it over to a CRM like Podio, and then hand dial them, you know, we're instead keeping that lead in our dialer, having our acquisition manager power dial those homeowners. As soon as they pop up, he's clicking on Zillow, looking at the comps, looking in the price history, finding the sale before the sale, subtracting that 20K, and making that offer. It just helps us speed up that process so we're able to get 50 plus offers out the door. So to your point, it's the offers over appointment strategy.
Yeah, it's slick. And how often, or what would be the split between the ACT manager gets a commitment and someone says, you know what, we'll take the 110 grand versus you send them the offer for 110 and do a little follow-up after they initially said, no, the price isn't going to work? Is that like a 50-50, the deal's coming on the front end, sort of the instant close versus the follow-up, or some other different balance?
Yeah, it's different. Only about maybe 25% of the time we're able to get them to agree to our price that very first conversation. You know, it actually on average about 9 touches until we're getting a signed contract. So most are on that in that second group of folks that we sent over our best offer, and then we followed up with them, you know, making sure that they got the agreement and trying to continue to build rapport over time and get them to sign. It's more in that second group of just constant follow up, but he's just able to do his follow up so much more efficiently by keeping our leads in the dialer. So when he says, hey, I need to get in there and do some follow up, he's power dialing these leads and getting through them and connecting with homeowners live follow up, you know, faster than, you know, if he was hand dialing. And I prefer that. I prefer a live follow-up touch over some automated system that sends, you know, text messages and RVMs, you know, with some interval. Like, I'd rather him do live follow-up and talk details of the deal, details of the document, versus the person that's still calling and just trying to convince them to agree to some pie-in-the-sky number. You know, I feel like it allows us to cut in front of the line, because we said, hey, look, we sent over an agreement, we're ready to move forward. They're taking us a little bit more serious than the next person that's just calling and still trying to get them to agree to terms.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, it underscores the most valuable time that a real estate investor is going to invest in their business is going to be in the process of negotiating offers on the purchase side. I'll go out and say that that's more important than negotiating a deal on the sale side, because if you didn't buy the deal right in the first place, your sale side is already going to be severely impacted, no matter how great your sale side of the negotiation goes, or dealing with contractors, or going out and picking out cabinets and light fixtures and all the stuff you see on HGTV. Forget it all. Like, not necessarily forget it or disregard it, but the highest value time you can invest in your business is on the offers. And if you think back to the beginning of our conversation here, Brandon, that is the same thing that a lot of times is going to stop a newer, inexperienced, or an investor that's not getting a level of consistent results, is probably because they're not putting 50, 60, 70 offers per week into the market. So whether you're following up and dealing with agents and you're investing the time that way, or you're literally talking and communicating with the seller who you've already made an offer, either way, that time investment is the most valuable portion of the transactionally driven real estate investor's business. So fix and flipping, if you're on the acquisition side with your buy and hold rental portfolio, you know, if you're on the side where you're just managing your portfolio, obviously this is a different thing, and they probably checked out of this episode by now. The other thing I'm wondering, and probably the audience is too at this point, but how do you know the condition of the property? Are you doing this blind? Are they texting you photos? What's the deal with underwriting for condition?
Yeah, no, great question. That's $1 million question. I mean, honestly, I did not see a major drop off in canceled contracts or renegotiated agreements, you know, from when I was going to the property trying to, you know, estimate repairs versus once we just started to send offers based off of what sold in the market. You know, honestly, it was just the same type of contract fallout rate where, you know, there's going to be some deals that work and some that don't. But if we're basing our offer for subject property off of other homes that have sold in the area, we already have a feel for, in this particular area, what an investment deal will sell for. So if we're able to offer our property contract at a similar rate, at a similar price point, it's a deal. Because at the end of the day, the first thing that a buyer is going to do is they're going to look at comps in the area and say, hey, well, look, I see that, you know, this property, you know, sold for X, you know, and if we're able to offer a contract for our property at a similar price point, then it already makes sense. But to dive a little deeper into that question, when I'm looking at, my subject property, of course, there are going to be homes that are in better or worse condition. So when I'm looking at the comps that have sold and I see what they sold at, before a renovation, there's still going to be a range. There are going to be some, if I'm looking into an area and I see a bunch of fully fixed up, fully renovated properties also for $250 in the area, and then I look in the price history and most of them sold, a little below $100K. There are some that sold closer to $100K and some that sold, closer to $60,000. And so I would assume that the ones that closed, sold closer to $60,000 were more in the need of repairs. They were in worse shape before the renovation started. So my subject property, if the owner tells me, look, it was vandalized, it's completely messed up, it's going to need a full gut job, I'm going to be a little bearish on my offer and get closer to the homes that sold in the 60 range versus if a homeowner says, hey, the fundamentals are there. We actually replaced the roof, a few years ago. Yes, it needs a complete, update and renovation, but, the water heater is good. The AC unit is good. I'm going to be a little bullish and my offer is going to be on the higher end of what those other homes sold for before they were renovated. So it's still an estimate, we're still estimating, the value of our property based on its condition and what the homeowner tells us is the closer that we can get to, the price point that these other properties sold for before they were renovated. And once something goes under contract, we immediately go out, we immediately tell the homeowner we need two times to get in there, once for photos, and then a second time for our purchasing partners, contractors, any potential agents. And furthermore, the quicker you can, if any wholesalers are listening, the quicker you can get to the point where you're letting homeowners know that oftentimes, the majority of the times, you're going to immediately resell their property for profit to your network of buyers, the better off you'll be. Because all of us started off saying, hey, we're going to buy your home and we're going to fix and flip it or hold it as a rental. The quicker you can get to the point where you're telling them the truth, being a truth teller and a truth seeker, the smoother your transactions will go. And you'll be able to say, hey, look, I'm providing you value by quickly and conveniently allowing you to sell your property at the price point that we agreed upon. That's the value that I'm providing. The way that I do that is, my prerogative, and sometimes I'm going to immediately resell it for profit to someone in my network. So letting them know, being honesty is the best policy, is going to be super helpful. And then if you do get something under contract that's a little too high, renegotiate, the moral way and letting them know throughout the process the entire time. We do not go under contract with properties with the idea of renegotiating. Most of the time we're able to hit the right price point just basing our offer off of what other homes have sold in the area.
Yeah, that's interesting. So no photos are being sent during that negotiation at any point?
Not most of the times. There are some times that homeowners are adamant about us seeing the property prior. Sometimes they are. And we'll send our guy out to take photos, or we'll ask them to send photos. But, majority of the times, I would say, 6 to 7, if really 8 out of 10 times, we're able to go into contract without any photos, and without the seller, almost forcing us to come through their property. But it does happen.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you have a point. As I hear you talking, I'm thinking through my own experience. So I'm in Philadelphia, I'm in Chicago, and I'm in Atlanta, and we do a volume of deals in all three of those markets, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland. Like, we're in quite a few markets. And as you're talking, I'm thinking, yeah, you know what? You're right, Brandon. As I think through, I kind of have my Southside Chicago properties and the cash comps go through a certain range, and the ranges are for certain conditions. And it's like an anomaly when I have a burned out shell in the Southside of Chicago that's going to be, you know, significantly more money than one that at least had a family maybe living there in, within recent history. But then I go to Atlanta, and there's certain neighborhoods in Atlanta where the year of construction is around the same time. So if we're talking 30310, 30315, you know, Beltline, Southwest Atlanta area, we have older home inventory that's going to need significant improvement to be retail ready. And it's probably only going to be this like investor fixing and flipping type of mentality there in most cases versus, you know, finding one that was renovated 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah, they come through sometimes in their kind of rental condition, but age of the inventory that sells to cash buyers in Southwest Atlanta is going to be different than some other areas where the construction is all newer construction built in, like, let's say 70s, 80s, and 90s, like up in Beaufort and Hall County. A lot newer construction
right,
for the most part there. Yeah, so you get,
right,
like you're talking about, the simple way of, you know, summing it all up, you can actually underwrite the condition almost by looking at the comps and like comparing the year of the build of the subject property to the year of the build of the properties around it, and getting a feel for the pictures. But that's not a skill that's going to come easy on the front end. I'm curious how long it took you to get the acquisition manager that you have running things up to speed on this like range thinking that you described about the condition.
No, great. Absolutely great question. I mean, I really think it was about 3 to 6 months before he started to feel comfortable. But even throughout, you know, what he always does is we use Slack to communicate within our business. If he has something that he had a question on, he would just send me over the address, the condition of the property, what the homeowner want, and I gave him real-time feedback. So just a few addresses a day, each day, you know, over time would just allow him to get it, you know, and see it better and better over time. And then also I was able to just show him on a map, you know, just to your point, you know, different areas around the city where, you know, most of the price points will be for a wholesale transaction. So Southwest Atlanta, like inside the perimeter and south of I-20, which cuts across the city, you know, it's going to usually be around, you know, this price point. You're going to be able to offer, you know, you probably need to be under 100K. Or if it's in a really hot area towards the city, you can probably get up to, you know, 150, you know, on your offer price because those homes fully fixed up are well above, you know, 350. If you're outside the perimeter and, you know, north of the city, you're able to, you know, offer X. If you're east and west, like, so I was able to just kind of show them on the map, you know, assumed averages just based on history and experience. And then also just always giving him feedback, on a daily basis. He tells me, like, look at these addresses. And I was able to give him that feedback by looking at the map. And for me, it's something that I built over time. I'm somewhat of an analytical thinker, but I'm not too analytical where I absolutely have to look at all the numbers. I kind of have a touch and a feel for, you know, what buyers will pay. So when, as soon as you start thinking about these properties as a buyer would, like, would this be a good deal for me? Will I have enough room to do this work and still make this money? You know, then the better are you going to be at, you know, making your offers. Like, thinking as a buyer will help, you know, you really, you know, key in on your ability. That's a real estate investor's superpower. Being able to comp properties and have a feel for purchase price is our superpower. So always be working on that if you want to be successful in this business.
Nice. I love it. The other thing I want to circle back to again here for a moment, but you're disclosing the profit motive to a seller at some point early in this thing, or maybe when you get the contract out and you're saying, hey, I'm going to sell this property to someone in my network and make a profit. And it goes kind of right. It's kind of implied, like, well, why else would I be buying a property if I wasn't going to turn around and sell it at some point to make a profit? But it can be offensive if you're not disclosing that in some fashion up front. How often does that torpedo a deal, if at all? And if it does torpedo a deal, how do you mitigate that? Do you suddenly, you know, is it a good enough deal that you're willing to close on it? I mean, is there any other way to handle the objection that a seller might have if all of a sudden they find themselves offended that you're planning on making a profit on the deal for doing business.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it definitely can turn people off where they say, I absolutely do not want you assigning this contract to purchase my home, or, you know, wholesaling this, you know, property if they're really savvy. And, you know, we'll pivot very quickly and say, hey, you know, we do have other exit strategies. You know, we do have lending partners where we can purchase this home and then do whatever we want with it after we've purchased it from you. And that's exactly what I'll do. I'll reach out to, you know, a private lender in my network and actually purchase homes. And then either, and, you know, at that point, I'm going to list it on the open market. But, you know, it has to be a good enough deal. So yes, to your point, it can turn some people off, but not everybody. You sometimes have those really nice homeowners. There's one that we have under contract currently in Conyers. And we mentioned, you know, because it was in such great shape that, you know, we listed on the MLS, you know, even while we're just still under contract. We say, look, I absolutely don't care what you do with it. You know, just I want to, you know, receive X amount of money and I want to be able to close within 30 days. You know, on that particular home, it's such a good deal, like as far as kind of just being retail ready, that I am still going to purchase it and then lift it on the MLS so that I can accept the conventional home buyer offer. But, you know, it's just letting them know up front. And, you know, if they have an issue with it, we'll remove whatever language out of the agreement. Honestly, you sometimes can just double close on the property and still, you know, have a simultaneous transaction where we're purchasing a property using an end buyer's funds and then immediately reselling it. So we have options to go around, you know, what they see as us assigning their contract.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's funny though, that, right? So if we had hesitation we talked about around making the offer, eyewitness experienced people never wanting to bring up the profit motive the way you just described. It's like, don't bring that up. It's taboo. I'm not saying it, anything like that to jeopardize my contract. And they back themselves into a corner, because they sort of don't mention that ever. And now it creates, like you said, all these speed bumps further down the line in the deal. If they're trying to get contractors, partners, buyers, et cetera, through the deal, now all of a sudden, you know, the seller's like wondering what's going on versus bringing
right.
up.
Why
up
are
front.
These people?
Oh, you know,
exactly.
Yeah,
why
yeah.
are all these people at my property? I thought you were purchasing this property. You know, you just don't want to face those issues during your inspection or especially at the closing table.
Yeah. And to me, it's kind of like, you know what? It's like, hey, I'm going to make a profit. Like if you have a problem with that and there's someone else that you have lined up to buy the house, that's great. If you want to go explore that option, I'm here now. I'm ready to sign and I'm the one that's going to put a check in your hand. But of course, you know, I'm doing this because I'm in the business of making money, right? I win some, I lose some. But at the end of the day, I've got to make a profit here for the business to continue on. Is what it is.
100%.
So let's switch gears again here. Let's talk the Atlanta market. So tell me where you came from. I think you said you moved to Atlanta. Was the reason that you moved to Atlanta because the real estate market was hot?
No. So, you know, I was born up near Chicago, but moved here when I was 1 year old. So I'm raised here. I'm from Atlanta. But I went and graduated from Purdue University in Indiana. And my first job out of college was with the H.J. Heinz Company in Pittsburgh. And they were going to move me to three different cities in, you know, 3 different years, and then they got purchased. So they moved me out to Illinois, Iowa, and then they got acquired, canceled my job. I had a young child, and I was driving back and forth, but I found a job with the Kraft Oscemeyer Company, and then they got bought out by the same company that bought the Heinz Company. So we lived there for a little bit, and I started to look for an opportunities back here in Atlanta. I found a position with Talenti Unilever, and we were able to move back home. But before the year was up, I was fired. Literally 2 weeks after getting married to my wife, I got fired, and And I think that just goes to show that, you know, I was not the best employee. You know, I needed to be, you know, charting my own path. And so I knew nothing about real estate whatsoever. I got fired right in October. I reached out to my buddy in December. And as soon as he, you know, told me about wholesaling and I could follow this mentor program, by January 2016, I was fully in, you know, burned the bolts, you know, doing my own thing, hired my first team member, June of 2016, my administrative assistant. She's been with me ever since. She's my right hand, keeps my business together, and I've been operating it as a business since day one. So that really helped out, and all the corporate experience that I had allowed me to, you know, lead a team of cold callers and acquisition managers, and have a systematic approach to the business. So, you know, look, though I'm not using my degree directly, the operations management degree and corporate experience that I got right out of college definitely played a role in my success. So, you know, there is something to say about going to school and getting your education. You can leverage that in the business world in the right sense.
Yeah, I think that's good to say. Congratulations on getting fired, by the way.
Best thing that ever happened to me, man. Best thing.
Yeah, yeah. And you're not the only one. We've heard that a few other times on the show, and I know a lot of people personally who that was the case and the catalyst for getting started in real estate. But I like to underscore the part about you saying that the degree did actually translate into what you're doing now, and I think it is something. So I dropped out of college and got right to doing stuff, but that's not really the case. I dropped out because I wasn't disciplined enough to finish it. And I got bored quickly with that and kind of wanted to get off and get to work. So that was the end of engineering school for me. But I think that you are absolutely right in a lot of the stuff that I had to learn from books and self-teach and through hard-won experience. I know for a fact that stuff is quickly available and you can assimilate that into the way of your thinking through business school, management, and a lot of other courses that you could take in college. And I know that a lot of people in, you know, the real estate thing and even in the world right now, there's kind of this like anti higher education backlash sort of amongst entrepreneurs. You know, everyone wants to quit and be Bill Gates or quit and be Mark Zuckerberg. But that's not always the entire situation. So that's a great point there to highlight your experience.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and I have, 4 young children. And by the time of this release, we'll probably have announced that one more is on the way.
nice.
But, you know, I appreciate it, but I'm going to still allow them, you know, if they want to go to school and have that experience, by all means, do so. But I will also offer them, the option is if you are, you know, starting a business, if you're doing the entrepreneurial thing, you know, in high school and things are looking good, you know, I will allow them to choose whether or not they want to continue on going to college. But, you know, if they don't have anything in the works, you know, definitely. I think that there is value in a degree and that experience, the fun that you get, the camaraderie that you have from your college experience. I still have all my engineering buddies. We meet on a Zoom call or Google Hangout, you know, every few months. And those are lifelong friends, you know, white guys out of Indiana, that I'm still kicking it with from, you know, virtually. We do a little reunion every once in a while too. So I want them to have that experience. There is something about that, that you can't replicate just jumping into the business world with bills and issues, you know. There's some value to an education for sure.
Yeah, my daughter's she's at Temple right now, and obviously with the pandemic going on, it's like could have been done virtually. And she was kind of she knew enough that she wanted the experience, so we kind of got the apartment. They're canceling the dorms now. They're back on. They're allowed to stay there now. They have a couple in person classes, so it's been a whipsaw of a year. But she's getting the experience, you know. I'm in Chicago, she's in Pennsylvania, and she's like away at school. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that should be crazy for these kids that are going through this. you know, through COVID. Like, I can't imagine, but, you know, hopefully she's still enjoying herself. And, you know, that's good that she still allowed her. Is she wanting to be an entrepreneur as well?
She's kind of scared of that, and she feels like, hey, I can always come work for Dad, you know, at some point if I can't figure out something else. So she is into, like, occupational therapy, I think it was one of them. So she switched her major, I think, this year, and she liked personal training and wanted to do her own personal training business. But there's, you know, a certain amount of experience that comes in selecting the right business opportunity also, which I think she'll probably develop that at some point. But, hey, she's doing her.
That's awesome. The kids are a blessing, man.
Yeah, man. That's why I moved out to Chicago. So I'm from Philadelphia, and 2005 or six is when my daughter moved here with her mom. And then 5 or 6 years ago now, I moved to Chicago so I could be here for her middle school and high school years right before she left to go back to Philadelphia for college, where I'm originally from. So gotta love it.
Life, man. That's cool.
Yeah. So let's talk books, right? We get our wisdom, we get our knowledge. Is there any books? Is there a book or two maybe that you recommend to people or that you found pivotal, business, real estate, or otherwise, that you think would be valuable for the listeners to check out?
Yeah, there's a few great books. I mean, I definitely always suggest Profit First as you're getting going, making sure that you have a game plan for your money. The One Thing, something to try to live by, sometimes tougher said than done. The E-Myth, if you're really wanting to be an entrepreneur, and then Traction as you get going and you want to, you know, you're building a team and you're wanting to get them, you know, have some structure to, you know, your business and, your meeting schedule and meeting rhythm. But for anybody out there that's cold calling, I highly, highly suggest, Fanatical Prospecting by Jeb Blount. That's something that I think everybody that's going to be on the phone, should definitely, listen to it or read. So I gave a slew of books there.
I wrote them all down. That's a new one. Fanatical Prospecting by Jeb Blount.
Yeah, that's a great one.
All right. So this is the REI Diamond Show, Brandon, and at the end we talk about our crown jewel of wisdom, and I'm going to set the stage here. So let's say it's like 2015, 2016. Your bank account is at near zero, right? No deals waiting on the board to close. And yes, you did it with the postcards originally, but if you had to restart your career knowing what you know now, how would you get started?
Yeah, but I would go directly to the courthouse. And I would pull the probate records and the eviction records of recently filed evictions and probate. I would do that every week and find a way to contact those, either the petitioner that petitioned for probate or the plaintiff that, you know, filed the eviction. And I would be contacting them by any means necessary, preferably by the phone. But if you're really hungry and really gritty, go knock on the door, if you absolutely have to. Those would be the immediate steps that I would do in any city. You could drop me anywhere in the country. I'm going straight to the courthouse, finding the records from the source and trying to contact them as quickly as possible from the moment that they filed these cases.
And you talk about how quickly as possible, and you also mentioned doing this every week. So, you know, these lists are sometimes available usually on a monthly pool. How important is it to do it every week? Is that because there's other people doing the same thing and you've got to kind of get there first? Is that why this is part of the, you know, crown jewel of wisdom for you?
100%. I think you get the first mover advantage if you cut the curve and go weekly. Because every week in a major county, you can get 30, you know, actual leads. From our major counties, there's probably about 50 records filed a week and 30 of them own real estate. So there's so many, list providers and vendors that only allow these, lists, make these lists available, to their clients monthly, go weekly, beat them to the punch and be the first person to reach out. And that little extra with the probate process, though, is if you can go under contract with a homeowner and write in the agreement, this transaction will close after the probate process is complete. So, you know, there's going to be people that say, oh, I can't sell it to you right now. We can still go under contract so that as soon as they get their letters of testamentary, you could be closing literally the next day. And then the one little gem I'll add in there is if I needed to find my buyers, I would go out and put bandit signs around the area, the major intersections around where the property I have under contract is located. Desperate, 3 beds, 2 baths, cash investors only, and my phone number. That's how I get my buyers and close the deal.
Do you still do the bandit signs today?
I don't. I did it in 2017. That's really how I built up a lot of my best buyers from that original way of pulling, of getting buyers. And then I really grew my list by swapping with other investors in the city, a one-to-one swap of our list. And,
nice.
You know, I gotten up to like 15, 16,000 and then deleted out all the people that weren't, opening the emails. So I have about 8,000-9,000 strong buyers on my email list.
Nice. Love it. All right, cool. Well, hey, I appreciate you coming on the show here. What should listeners do if they want to get more Brandon Barnes?
Yeah, for sure. Head over to sendmoreoffers.com. All my links to my social are there. Anywhere that I'm putting content out, you can follow me. And if you're interested in learning more about, you know, how we send more offers, and, you know, want to talk about your goals, see if you're a good fit for the program and want some additional resources, book a call with me. You can do that right on the website, www.sendmoreoffers.com. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, and one tip, too, is put in the www. I'm not sure if it's just my browser or not, but the first time I tried to punch it in without the www, it gave me like some kind of Google error. But once I put the www in there, it actually went straight to the site.
Yeah, that's why I said like that. I don't know why I got to get that fixed, but yeah, definitely put that in. And I look forward to hearing from you guys.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, thanks again, Brandon. Really appreciate you being on the show, and we'll catch up soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Dan.
So are you interested in doing deals with no money down? You know, creative financing? Sounds like a good idea, right? Then you might consider diving deeper into the mortgage note business. The mortgage note business is the creative financing strategy in real estate. First, negotiate no money down deals with sellers. Then find a buyer willing and able to put some money down and continue making payments until the deal is paid off, with a profit for you in between. And one of the things with creative financing is that you can sell properties for much higher prices using creative financing. So here's an example. I bought a package deal a few years ago, and as part of the package, I think there were 5 houses that I really wanted because they were in the right area, and there was a 6th house for $20,000 not in the right area. That house that I had to buy for $20,000 as part of the package, it was worth about $20,000. And I tried selling the house on the market for $20,000, you know, plus or minus, leaving the room for the commission, but to no avail. The house did not sell. So I removed the listing and I wrote a Craigslist ad offering that same house for $45,000. And this time I added creative financing. So the deal sold for a price of $45,000 with $8,500 down, and $443 per month for 10 years. So the deal was off my plate collecting payments. Now, if the deal runs all the way through the 10 years, I'll end up with a total of $61,660 on a deal I couldn't sell that I had to buy for $20,000, which amounts to a profit of $41,660. Not a bad deal on a deal that I couldn't even sell to break even, right? So what's the best way to learn about creative financing, no money down deals, and the mortgage note business? Well, you're in luck. My friend Brian Lochner is hosting a full-day virtual workshop in a few weeks on exactly that topic. And normally this costs $97 to attend, but as an REI Diamond Show listener, you can attend free when you register at reinoteschool.com. This class is a full day of content, tons of examples of real deals, and of course many of these deals are the crowd favorites. No money down and extracting a nice chunk of cash up front, followed by years of additional payments. So go check the schedule and sign up at reinoteschool.com. Thanks again for tuning in. Remember to review and subscribe on your podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. To receive the episode highlights via email, sign up at reidiamonds.com. At that site, you can also access the full episode archive of Wealth Building Real Estate Investment Jewels of Wisdom. Again, that's reidiamonds.com. So my main business, Diamond Equity Investments, is that of buying, renovating, and selling houses. 283 in 2020 and 30 bought and sold so far in 2021. And we currently have another 114 houses in our inventory, either under construction, for sale, or awaiting closing. So here's how we can do business. Number one, are you interested in having access to the best real estate deals in your market? In other words, access to deals you can buy at low enough prices to actually profit after renovating and reselling? If so, go now to accessrealestatedeals.com. Number two, are you an accredited investor who enjoys double-digit returns? If you'd like to potentially invest passively in my real estate deals, go to fundrehabdeals.com and sign up to receive my private mortgage investment opportunity emails. And number three, finally, I am always buying houses that I can flip, and I buy occupied apartment buildings with below market rents. So if you have a deal that fits that description in either Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, please send me an email with the details. We are at the conclusion, my friend. Next up, we have Avery Carl joining us to discuss a few of the hottest vacation rental real estate markets in the southeastern U.S. and exactly how you can get your piece. Catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.